This is Reverend Munther Isaac from the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, Palestine, giving his Easter sermon on March 31st, 2024.
Dear friends, good evening from Bethlehem, and thank you for joining from different parts of the world. We're grateful for technology that can bring us in such a manner from different parts of the world. Easter has come upon us in Palestine in the most difficult circumstance. It has been 175 days since this genocide began. 175 days of bombardment, siege, and starvation. I would have never thought that we would still be witnessing this by Easter. I thought surely this violence would have stopped by now. I thought world leaders do have some conscience at the end of the day. I was wrong, apparently. Today we have entered a new phase of the war of genocide, in which the people of Gaza are being killed by hunger, thirst, and disease. They are starved to death. It is a slow death. They are hanging between heaven and earth, dying slowly while the world is watching. They have no form or majesty that we should look at them. From whom men hide their faces. It took more than 5 months and 32,000 people killed, including 13,000 children, for the UN Security Council to finally pass a ceasefire. But nothing has changed on the ground. Since when does Israel care about UN resolutions? Israel has never been held accountable or even condemned by Western leaders. This remains the single biggest problem today. Right now, we are pleading for aid and food to enter. We gave up on a ceasefire. Just bring food, water, and medicine. Lord, have mercy. Friends, a genocide has been normalized. And as people of faith, if we truly claim to follow a crucified Savior, we can never be okay with this. We should never accept the normalization of a genocide. We should never be okay with children dying from starvation, not because of drought or famine, but starvation, man-made catastrophe because of the empire. A genocide has been normalized just as apartheid was normalized in Palestine. And before that, in South Africa, just as slavery and the caste system were normalized. It has been firmly established to us that the leaders of the superpowers and those who benefit from the modern colonialism do not look at us as equal. They created the narrative to normalize genocide. They have a theology for it. A genocide has been normalized. This is racism at its worst. And the very same political and church leaders who lined up in October, one after the other, to give the green light for this genocide, giving it the cover of self-defense, cannot even bring themselves to condemn the obvious war crimes being committed by Israel. They are good at raising their concern, make statements that they are troubled by the killing of our children. We're sorry that the killing of our children by your weapons actually troubled you. They want to convince us that they actually care. So they raise funds, they are silent during the genocide, and then show up afterwards with charity to say that they care. Can we really accept this? Many countries rushed to suspend their funding of UNRWA based on mere allegations that were not fully proven, yet did nothing with regards to the clear findings of the ICJ. The amount of hypocrisy is incomprehensible, and the level of racism involved for such hypocrisy is appalling. And now some politicians claim that their patience with Israel is ending, and we say nothing can wash the blood from your hands. The UN Security Council resolution was too late. It means nothing. Some acted as if we should congratulate or thank the USA for not vetoing the resolution. I say absolutely not. They are complicit. You cannot undo the past. In fact, the US has just sent another massive missile package to arm Israel. Are they really trying to fool us, claiming that they care or concern, obviously to win back some votes? If the flow of US weapons stopped right now, within 3 days, this would end. Instead, they sent Israel missiles to kill us, and then send fractions of the needed food parcels. This is beyond complicit. This is direct involvement in this. In this Easter, we turn first to the cross. We are mourning. These are dark, dark days. And in times like this, we Palestinians look at the cross, identify with the cross, and see Jesus identifying with us. The cross is an important Palestinian symbol. In Easter, we relive his arrest, torture, and execution at the hands of empire, with the complicity of a religious ideology, of course. In the Easter story, we find comfort and empowerment in knowing that Jesus identifies with us. We have kept this rubble in our church since the time of Christmas, because Gaza is still under the rubble, and because our people and our children in Gaza are still being pulled from under the rubble at this very moment. Yesterday, I watched with anguish a cruel scene of a child pulled from under the rubble. He miraculously survived the bombing, and thank God. But while he was being pulled out, he was saying, "Where is water? I am thirsty." This reminded me of the words of Jesus on the cross when he cried out, "I am thirsty." He cried out, "I am thirsty," in solidarity with those being massacred by famine, siege, and bombardment. Jesus stands in solidarity with all the victims of wars and forced famine caused by the unjust and tyrannical regimes in our world. It is the cry of every oppressed by the injustice of power and humanity's silence and inability to put an end to tyranny and injustice. Jesus shouted, "I am thirsty." So they gave him vinegar to drink. They added more pain to his pain, more anguish to his anguish. And today, while Gaza screams, "I am thirsty," they drop aid from the sky, stained with the blood of innocents. Some were killed by drowning while trying to pull the dropped aid from the sea. How cruel. Gaza is thirsty, and they give Gaza. We searched for God in this war. We cried out to him, and there was no answer. There was no answer, it seems, until we encountered the Son of God hanging on the cross, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken? Why did you let me be crucified alone?" This is the cry of feeling abandoned. And I am sure this is how the people of Gaza feel today. Abandonment from the world leaders. Not only the Western, by the way, but also Arab and Muslim leaders abandoned us. Many in the church also watched from distance. I think like Peter in the gospel, when he watched Jesus, when he was arrested, he stood from distance. He wanted to be safe. He lacked the courage, similar to many church leaders today who say one thing behind closed doors and another in public. Yet it is in this cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, that we experience God, that God draws near to us. And it is in this cry that we feel his embrace and warmth. This is one of the mysteries of Easter. In this land, even God is the victim of oppression, death, the war machine, and colonialism. He suffers with the people of this land, sharing the same fate with them. My God, why have you forsaken me? It is a cry that has resonated for years in this land. It is the cry of every oppressed person hanging in a state of slow death. It is a cry that Jesus shared with us in his pain, torment, and crucifixion. Today, we place the cross on the rubble, remembering that Jesus shared the same fate with us as he died on the cross as a victim of the colonizer. And it became dark. The universe became dark in grief over the absence of truth. The universe became dark, lamenting the absence of justice. The cross is the ultimate injustice. Today, the universe is saddened by the silence of decision makers and their racism, and by the silence of many who did not speak a word of truth out of fear, armed with the theology of neutrality and inaction under the banner of peace and reconciliation. There are still those who did not openly call for a ceasefire. Can you believe this? churches. We received recently a letter of solidarity, I'm not kidding, from large churches in Europe that did not even call for a ceasefire. And I told them, this is actually an absolute. Today the universe became dark, lamenting the apathy and numbness to suffering that exists in our world and the racism that led to normalizing and justifying it. What many in the church lack the most today is courage. They know the truth, but they are not speaking the truth because they fear the consequences. They fear the backlash. Many in the church want to avoid controversy. Can you imagine if Jesus walked on earth avoiding controversy? There are some church leaders who are willing to sacrifice us for comfort, the same way they offered us as an atonement sacrifice for their own racism and anti-Semitism, repenting on our land over a sin they committed in their land. All of this while claiming to follow a crucified Savior who sacrificed everything, endured pain and rejection for the sake of those he loved. We, of course, must thank those who carried our cross with us, and there are many. We really appreciate, to name few, the Gaza pilgrimage taking place all over the world. We thank those who came to Palestine to be in solidarity with us. We thank the doctors and nurses volunteering in Rafah. We thank those lobbying to stop weapon sales. We thank those demonstrating in the streets. Today there was a big demonstration in London again. We thank those who did many sit-ins and nonviolent protests. We thank those who keep disturbing the comfort of world leaders in gatherings and press conferences and fundraisers. We hear you. This is the Church of Christ. And we salute those who resigned from government and international bodies in protest. They have courage and integrity. They understand that Gaza is indeed the moral compass of our world today. We thank South Africa for its action in the ICJ and Algeria for leading the efforts for a ceasefire resolution. Both South Africa and Algeria, by the way, are survivors of Western colonialism. It is there where the moral credibility lies. We are carrying a heavy cross, and we thank those who help us carry it. Our Friday has lasted way too long. But we know from the experience of Jesus that this suffering is not for the glorification of suffering. We know that suffering is always a path to glory and life. It is a stop on the road to resurrection. We walk with Jesus on the road of Golgotha. We are empowered by his solidarity with us, but we look for Sunday. And so on Easter, we don't only look to the cross, but we turn to the empty tomb. When I think of what gave Jesus this strength, this resilience and power, to the extent that he forgave his oppressors, to the extent that he said, "Your will be done," and went voluntarily to the cross, I believe his resolve and determination, his resilience, his sumud, came from trusting his Father's will and from knowing that his Father is able to raise him from the dead and that he will ultimately do that, raise him from the dead. Jesus' faith sustained and empowered him. He was defiant in the face of empire. He faced the cross and even death with confidence and steadfastness. And I must admit, it is so difficult today to hold to our faith. It is so difficult to hold to hope. We cannot see Sunday. It seems an impossibility. We are swallowed by the darkness of the tomb. Our strength has failed. We are weary. It is so hard to speak of the resurrection now. We are mourning. Our siblings in Gaza are literally dying from starvation, but we cannot lose our faith in God. This is our last resort. And as such, we have to fight to keep this faith. We cannot lose our faith. We have to look to the empty tomb. We must remember the empty tomb. And so today I preach to myself first with the psalm. Why are you cast down, O my soul? And why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. Why are you cast down, O man? The resurrection gives us hope. Christianity is a faith that hopes. And hope is not to deny the reality. We are not blind to our reality. And we as Palestinians realize the corruption and evil of the world probably more than anybody else. But we must refuse to let this be the last word. Christ is risen. This is the final word. Christ is risen, and this changes everything. The empty tomb is our hope. And behind the ugly apartheid wall in Bethlehem, separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem, and specifically in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, there is an empty tomb that reminds us that the last word is not that of death, but of life. Not that of darkness, but of light. Not that of genocide and starvation, but of dignity. The empty tomb reminds us that evil, injustice, tyranny cannot have the last word. See, if Christ had remained in his grave, Caesar and Pilate would have triumphed. Rome would have won, and the Pharisees. The oppressors would have been victorious. But Christ is risen. The empire is defeated. And even better, death. And so because we have faith, we do not live in despair. Faith is the only thing they cannot take away. And so when we declare on Easter Sunday, Al-Masih Qam, Christ is risen, we declare that the final word belongs to God. We declare that justice is served, truth is vindicated, the empire and its allies lost. And today, after 2,000 years, by continuing to carry the cross, we defeat and even mock the empire and its theology. We took the symbol of Rome's power and the means of its humiliation of others and made it the symbol of our strength, victory, and steadfastness in the face of death. And this is because Al-Masih Qam, Christ is risen. And the resurrection urges us to rise and act. Because we know that the final word belongs to God, we rise and act. We build. We preach love because we know love wins. We preach peace because peace wins. We preach life because death is defeated. Jesus stared death in the face and defeated it. And therefore, we rise and act. So in conclusion, friends, I am confident that we, the Palestinians, never in my life have I been prouder and more honored to be a Palestinian more than the last 175 days. Proud of our resilience, our sumud. I'm proud of our solidarity with one another, our unity. And when I say we will be okay and that we will recover, I say it because I know my people. I know who we are. Palestine is our homeland. We are deeply rooted here. And even for those Palestinians exiled around the world, Palestine lives in them. Palestine today is in every corner of this earth. So we will never relinquish our God-given rights of living in dignity and justice. Yet I also say we will recover because I believe in a good and a just God who rules the world. Probably our biggest asset is the justice of our cause. This is our biggest asset as Palestinians. Our sumud, our steadfastness is anchored in our just cause and in our historical rootedness, but it's also anchored in the just nature of God. And so because Jesus lives, we can face all things, stare the empire in the face. So today, let the way of the cross be our way. Let the way of the sacrificial love be our way. The crucified Christ, who sacrificed his love for the sake of those he loved, calls us for costly solidarity. The costly solidarity of love. This is a call to action. For the church to be the church, to be Jesus' church, to follow in the footsteps of a crucified. The cross is God's solidarity with humanity in its pain and suffering. And God's solidarity must become our solidarity. The followers of Jesus risk all to This is not about making statements. Jesus did not say, I was hungry and you prayed for me and made a statement. No. Jesus said, I was prisoner and you came to me. This is about, we must find ways to make a difference. We must act, mobilize, pressure, lobby, hold powers and leaders accountable. And as people of the resurrection, we must unsettle the empire. Today, the land of the resurrection calls you to act in hope and love. Today, the land of the resurrection called you to unsettle the empire. Together, we are committed to end this genocide. Together, we are committed to work for truth and justice. We know we will prevail because Al-Masih come, Christ is. Amen.
This is Francesca Albanese delivering her report to the United Nations on Tuesday, March 26, 2024. Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine.
Provided military, economic, and political support for the atrocity, compounding the devastation it has wrought for the Palestinians. In this assault, the sixth and most egregious in 16 years, Israel has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians, including 13,000 children, more than the children killed in all conflicts worldwide in four previous years. Journalists, doctors, nurses, artists, academics, engineers, scientists, and their family members, a whole society has been targeted. A further 12,000 Palestinians are reported missing, most presumed dead. Some 71,000 Palestinians are reported missing, some 71,000 are injured, most with life-changing wounds, made worse by the decimation of the healthcare system and overwhelming unsanitary conditions created in Gaza. In the first 2 weeks, Israel prevented all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, and in the ensuing months, it has imposed extreme restrictions of water, food, electricity, and fuel. Israel has blocked the entry of medical supplies, including anesthetics, incubators, and even baby formula. Convoys have hardly reached northern Gaza. The deliberate policy has induced rapid and sustained severe food insecurity in the entire population, with those trapped in the north forced to eat animal feed and grass. The occupying power has also undermined UNRWA, the main lifeline to Palestinians in Gaza. Growing numbers of Palestinians are dying of starvation as we speak. And the hostages and their families have also not escaped these devastating circumstances. The collective scars of those who survive are certain to last generations. In the initial weeks of the assault, Israeli forces killed around 250 Palestinians daily through an apocalyptic arsenal of weaponry on one of the most densely populated places on Earth. 25,000 tons of explosives, equivalent to two nuclear bombs, unguided munitions, and hundreds of 2,000-pound bunker busters were used to level entire neighborhoods. The ground offensive changed the pattern, but not the scale of destruction. In less than 6 months, Israel has destroyed Gaza, erasing or severely damaging almost all civilian infrastructure and agricultural land, most of homes, healthcare facilities, telecommunication infrastructure, every university, most educational facilities, municipal services, mosques and churches, and innumerable cultural heritage sites, which are integral to the social fabric of Palestine. Israeli soldiers have published footage boasting about their killing of families, mothers, children, the bombing of homes, mosques, and schools. Self-incriminating videos show them sadistically mocking and humiliating their Palestinian victims, not only by violating their physical integrity and right to life, but also their dignity, their most intimate possessions and spaces that the soldiers have entered and looted, and by desecrating cemeteries and places of worship. When the ground offensive started, the number of daily casualties seemed to reduce, but in fact, the level of atrocities increased. Mass disappearance and arbitrary detentions, widespread and systematic torture and inhumane treatment add to the experience of endless death and loss. Desperate people had to search through rubble with their bare hands. Many have been unable to bury and grieve loved ones. These acts of genocide have been motivated by vehement anti-Palestinian discourse, which characterizes the entire Palestinian people in Gaza as enemies to be eradicated or forcibly removed. This rhetoric has been pervasive across all segments of Israeli society. That Israeli high-ranking officials with command authority routinely called on soldiers to annihilate the people of Gaza is compelling evidence of explicit and public incitement to commit genocide. Evidence further indicates that this genocidal incitement has been internalized and acted upon by soldiers on the ground. One of my key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted rules of international humanitarian law, distinction, proportionality, and precaution in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people by deliberately stretching the definitions of human shield, evacuation orders, warnings, safe zones, collateral damage, and medical protection, Israel has used their protective function as humanitarian camouflage, with the effect of concealing patterns of conduct from which the only inference can reasonably be drawn is a state policy of genocidal violence against the Palestinians. Blurring the distinction between protected civilians or civilian infrastructure and combatants or legitimate military targets, Israel has effectively characterized the whole civilian population in Gaza as human shields or terrorist accomplices as a matter of legal policy. Those who managed to evacuate to areas that Israel defined as safe humanitarian zones have been met with further attacks, their deaths and injuries justified as collateral damage. By making repeated claims which have been systematically discredited that Hamas used hospitals as operation centers, Israel appears to be operating on the premise that if you tell a lie long enough, people will believe it. Israel has used the camouflage of humanitarian law to characterize the entire Palestinian people and life-sustaining and life-saving infrastructure of Gaza as targetable, killable, destroyable. Israel has attempted to legitimize, for example, the devastations of Gaza's medical infrastructure, which has led to potentially thousands of additional deaths, life-changing injuries and trauma. IHL has thus been distorted to justify a war of annihilation. In light of this, I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. The genocide in Gaza is the most extreme stage of a long-standing settler colonial process of erasure of the native Palestinians. For over 76 years, this process has oppressed the Palestinians as a people in every way imaginable, crushing their inalienable right to self-determination demographically, economically, territorially, culturally, and politically. Israel has attempted to displace them, expropriate their land and other resources, and ultimately replace them. The colonial amnesia of the West has condoned Israel's colonial settler project from the violent history of the very birth of the State of Israel to its oppressive occupation since 1967, the crippling closure of Gaza since 1993, and its military assaults on Gaza since 2007. The world now sees the bitter fruit of the impunity afforded to Israel. This was a tragedy foretold. While the International Criminal Court will have to deliberate, the International Criminal Court will have to investigate, it is my responsibility to remind you that the Genocide Convention includes a jus cogens norm and erga omnes obligation to prevent the commission of genocide, a reality the International Court of Justice recognized as plausible exactly 2 months ago. The time for states to act was then, and as they did not, the time is now. In this darkest hour, the international community cannot continue to ignore that it's Israel's project to rid Palestine of Palestinians in defiance of international law and the world's failure to call Israel to account. that has led to genocide laid bare in Gaza. Denial of the reality and the continuation of Israel's impunity and exceptionalism is no longer viable, especially in light of yesterday's binding Security Council resolution. I implore member states to abide by their obligations, which start with imposing an arms embargo and sanctions on Israel, and so ensure that the future does not continue to repeat itself. Thank you.
I thank you.
Okay, if you were just joining us, we were just listening to the UN Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, presenting her report to the Human Rights Council, saying that there are reasonable grounds that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza.
Next, we have the opinion of independent presidential candidate Cornel West on Gaza.
Netanyahu, you know, he's the Trump of Israel, just like Trump is the Netanyahu of America. They're both consistent gangsters.
Dr. Cornel West is one of America's most prominent scholars and activists. He's written over a dozen books and taught at some of the country's most prestigious universities. And now he's running for president as an independent, and he joins us to talk Gaza, Biden, and the U.S. elections. Dr. Cornel West, thank you so much for joining us on Real Talk Online.
No, thank you, my dear brother. Appreciate the coming conversation.
How do you define the U.S. government's Gaza policy currently?
You know, it reminds me in many ways of Vietnam in the times of Martin Luther King Jr., Stokely Carmichael, and Diane Nash, that Gaza is a historic turning point in the American empire.
A historic turning point, you're saying?
That's right. Historic, pivotal point in the history of the American empire. Very much like the Algerian War with the French Empire between 1954 and 62. Very much like the Suez Canal in 1956 vis-a-vis the British Empire. The American empire is in the process of deep decline and decay. And what Gaza does is rip the veil and reveal an American criminality, an American hypocrisy, an American immorality that's been parading as this force for democracy and force for freedom around the world. Now, of course, so many brothers and sisters, especially in the global South, have seen this before, given all of the U.S. supports of the coups. We've seen it in Iran. We've seen it in Guatemala. We've seen it in Grenada. We've seen it in so many other places, overthrowing democratic governments. But the whole world now sees in real time immeasurable, indescribable suffering of our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, with genocidal assaults, with ethnic cleansing, and the apartheid conditions, so that Israel, as a satellite of the American empire, becomes the mediating force to reveal to the world the American criminality. Now, of course, it's also Israeli criminality as well. But for the most part, it could not proceed without American money, without American bombs, without American military support, and without American cover at the United Nations.
Well, if I bring it to what's happening in the political climate today on the U.S. front, recently when Kamala Harris was asked if, you know, U.S. aid to Israel would be used as leverage, she said we mustn't conflate between the Israeli people and the Israeli government, which sends a message that, you know, that the U.S. wouldn't use aid as some sort of leverage. How do you see that?
Well, it's not even a question of the aid or not. Just look at how morally bankrupt the U.S. policy is in terms of creating a port on the one hand, and you're providing billions and billions of dollars to facilitate and enable the genocide on the other. Why? Because you won't confront the right-wing Jewish elites who are themselves making the decision to pursue the genocide, but America creates a condition for that pursuit. And so Kamala Harris and the others would have to acknowledge, and I've said this on many occasions, their particular policy makes them war criminals. And there's no way you can attenuate your war criminality by providing humanitarian aid. No, you've got to shatter the conditions for the very possibility of the genocide. You don't allow the genocide and then come in with some charity. No, not at all. Not at all. It's the larger framework that needs to be examined. And I tell you this, my brother, at a very deeper moral level, because I speak also as one coming out of the revolutionary Black Christian tradition of Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer. The fundamental problem of Washington's imperial policies is that they really do not believe that a Palestinian life and a Palestinian baby has the same value as a Jewish life and a Jewish baby.
You don't think
because
they see it that way?
If this would happen, they don't see it that way because their assumptions are so deep. But everybody knows, and the whole world knows, if there were a Palestinian genocidal assault on Jews and Jewish babies were being killed at the level and intensity that Palestinian babies were being killed, the U.S. government have a qualitatively different policy. In fact, the U.S. government would support the Jewish version of Hamas because, you know, U.S. government has a history of supporting various groups that kill innocent people when they conform with U.S. foreign interests. So you can see when there's white babies or Jewish babies, we have one response. When there's Palestinian babies or brown babies or black babies, we have another response. So there's a racist element here. And that needs to be pointed out, and that would be also part of a West administration telling the truth. The condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak, my brother.
Well, I guess the obvious question here, Dr. West, is, well, what would you be doing if you were in the White House in this situation?
Oh, if I was in the White House, first I'd have to tell the American people and the world the truth. I'd have to tell the truth, going back to 1970 with the Balfour Declaration and the British Empire providing this particular land for Jewish people. Now, Jewish people themselves have been terrorized and traumatized. There's no, and hated for 2,000 years. There's no doubt about that. That was a European greed and hatred. And Jews jumped out of those burning buildings of Europe and landed on the backs of Arabs. And they told lies. They said there was nobody there. They said there was no people there. That's not true. There were hundreds and thousands of people there. And they had to choose to coexist or dominate. And they opted for Jabotinsky. And of course, Netanyahu's father was an assistant for Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky said what? We must dominate and, if possible, annihilate these people. Well, see, that's sick. That is as fascist as you can get. And so the American people need to know the truth. Then you move to policy. Mm. And you say, that's why we're going to end the occupations. We're going to end the siege. We're going to stop the war. We're going to make sure that we do all we can to ensure that there is Palestinian dignity and equality, as well as Jewish security and safety. We don't want the annihilation and we don't want the massacre of any peoples, no matter who they are. But we are not going to sit back and somehow think that you can have a security and safety of Jews on the necks of Palestinians. There's going to be equality and dignity across the board, and we're going to come together and come up with ways in which we can achieve that. That's what you would hear in a West administration.
Hmm. And if we bring it to Biden's recent comments, Dr. West, I mean, he said that he has a red line when it comes to Israel invading Rafah. Yeah, in the same interview, he said that he would also never leave Israel. Now, that's contradicting or confusing at best, don't you think?
Well, he's made it clear he has no red line. You know, he's just talking. He's just talking. I mean, he is the candidate who has received over $100 million from AIPAC. AIPAC is the lobby that ensures that congressmen and presidents and others will defer to Israeli policy. He's been at that for decades, so he doesn't really have a red line at all. What he's concerned about is the election. He's got myself and others coming at him directly with what? With the truth, with the love of people, including the love of Palestinian people. Mm. With what? People waking up and seeing his, not just hypocrisy, but his criminality.
That's what I wanted to get at. Is that why did you call him a war criminal? Or why do you call him a war criminal?
because what is taking place right now in Gaza is not just a war crime and a crime against humanity. It is a crime of genocide.
But he would disagree with you, Dr. West. I mean, he even just said in his recent interview, he basically refused to concede that it was a widely shared sentiment that what's happening in Israel, in Gaza, is genocide.
Well, I mean, we got the International Court of Justice that's already against him, but I don't even believe it's just a matter of the court. That if you see for yourself, based on the definition of genocide, which is the wholesale attack on the part or the whole of a group that undermines the condition of their living, from health care to food, starvation as weapon against them and so forth, that is genocide. And even people want to argue whether it's genocide or not, it's such a indescribable crime against humanity that even the semantic debate is a distraction. And he has no deep sense of urgency, no sense emergency about it. It's just a particular electoral political calculation that he makes. That's what upsets me about not just him, all of these Democrats who are enabling genocide. Each and every one of them, from the House, the Senate, the State House, the City Council. If you can't meet this moral test, it's clear that you have hardly any moral fiber in you as human beings. Now, as politicians, you can play the electoral game. But I come from a black folk. We were played the electoral game for over 200 and some years in American democracy. All the fashionable liberal politicians couldn't say a word about lynching. They couldn't even pass a lynching bill in the history of America. It began in 1901, and they finally passed it a few years ago. That's sick, my brother. That's true with my indigenous brothers and sisters here. And that's why this is a Malcolm X moment. The chickens are coming home to roost for the American empire. The chickens are coming home to roost for American democracy. You are going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, truth crushed to earth shall rise again. Lies hiding crimes cannot live forever. This is what we're experiencing right now. And you see it among the younger generation across the board, black, white, red. You see it among our Jewish brothers and sisters, and if not now, and Jewish Voices for Peace, and you certainly see it among Muslims and Arabs in the United States. And of course, we've got our own critique of the Arab countries not having a sense of emergency and urgency here as well.
Sure. I'm going to get to the Arab American vote in a second, but I wanted to just to get your opinion on how you've been seeing Netanyahu's reactions to Biden's criticism. I mean, he's been basically doubling down and rejecting any of Biden's criticisms publicly.
Well, no, see, Netanyahu, you know, he's the Trump of Israel, just like Trump is the Netanyahu of America. They're both consistent gangsters. You see, they don't pander. He said, Netanyahu said up front, look, I am going to pursue this genocidal war, period. And he's got his talking points. We're going to kill all of Hamas so that 13,000 children, each one of them is a shield for Hamas. You see how sick that is? You see how ridiculous and ludicrous that is? But that's his talking point, and he follows through. So he has a consistency in his criminality and his gangster activity. Trump is the same way within the bounds of the American empire. It's Biden and others who want to act like they're so concerned.
I mean, Biden was caught saying that he'll have a come to Jesus meeting with Netanyahu soon in a hot mic. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
If he can't have a come to Jesus meeting after 10 innocent children are killed, let alone 13,000 are killed, you know that he's just talking. He's a hypocrite. He's not honest. He'll say almost anything to win votes.
Well, speaking of votes, let's talk about the Arab American vote. I mean, Biden's approval ratings, they went from 59% in 2020 to 17% in 2023 last year amongst the Arab American community. And, you know, obviously there's reports that he's going to face challenges in three battleground states, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania. How do you see this play out with the Arab American vote?
Well, he's simply not going to gain any significant Muslim or Arab American vote. There's no doubt about that. And no matter what it does, it's too late. It's too little, too late. There's too many precious Palestinians who have been not just murdered, but maimed. And even Palestinians who are alive. You know, what kind of lives are we talking about in the rubble, in the ruins? Let's be very, very honest about this. So that the very notion that somehow he can do X or Y as a way of responding to an electoral constituency whose grandmothers and grandfathers and mothers of fathers are being systematically murdered. You see, there's nothing he can do, and understandably so. And I think part of the problem is that he's incapable, it seems, of really casting this in a serious moral and spiritual framework. It's only tactical in regard to election. And that in and of itself is an insult to anybody, let alone Arabs and Muslims, to view the killings of our family members as just another moment for electoral political calculation.
Right. And is this why you said, Dr. West, is this why you said that the Democrats, they see Muslims and Arabs in the U.S. as interest groups?
That's right. But that's why they're beyond redemption. But this is what happens when empires begin to implode, and the willful blindnesses that they have render them actually contributing to their own destruction. And that's very much where we are as an empire. The whole world sees it, but on the inside, you've been to the country, you see, my God, the level of homelessness, the levels of poverty. They say the economy is doing so well, yet three individuals have wealth equivalent to 160 million people. Three individuals have wealth equivalent to 50% of the American citizenry, and yet you got all these pundits talking about how beautiful the economy is. You see, that kind of ideological cover is just as bad in some ways as the vetoes of the resolutions in the United Nations when you're calling for humanitarian aid of people undergoing genocide.
So you're saying the media has a role as well. The media is also complicit in your view.
Oh, a major role, my brother, a major role. They're supposed to be involved in truth-telling. Hmm. Where's the outrage when the Palestinian journalists or the progressive Israeli journalists who were killed, who were lied on? Where is the outrage for Julian Assange as a journalist exposing the lies of the American empire? And of course, we haven't even got to the great Mumia Abdul-Jamal and the great H.R.A.P. Brown or Amin Jamal Abdullah Al-Hamin and so forth, you see. So that we have to just be honest. And it's very difficult to be honest because it takes bravery and courage. And most of our politicians are cowards, man. They're in a system of legalized bribery and normalized corruption. They're well adjusted to an unjust status quo. They don't want to tell the truth. They don't want to straighten their backs up and pursue justice. And what does that mean? Well, it means for me, they are slapping Martin Luther King Jr. in the face in the grave. Yeah. And that for me is not just sacrilegious, but that is an undermining of the best of not just America. It's an undermining of the best of the human spirit.
And you have written so much about race relations, particularly in the U.S., Dr. West. And I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, how have you been seeing Gaza play out in the African-American communities in America?
Well, it's been a very, very sad affair in terms of black voices being too scared and intimidated to actually call for not just a ceasefire, but the end for occupation. So much of black organizations and black leaders themselves have been shaped by either AIPAC or being shaped by big influence, by big money, by big title that doesn't allow them to speak from the depths of their moral souls, which is another way of saying we've got sellout. We've got folk who have given up in serious truth-telling in order to preserve their positions. And this is true not just in government, it's true across the board. And so the black freedom struggle has always been the leaven in the American loaf. You see, it's always been the expander and the enabler in American democracy. Once you have so much black leadership that is intimidated and scared and afraid, then the Black freedom movement itself becomes weaker. And if it becomes weaker, it's no accident that Democratic forces as a whole become weaker. Now, there's other Democratic forces, which is beautiful. We talked about that before. The young people, the Arabs, the Muslims, and so forth. There's a gender element here, too. I think the women of different colors have been much, much stronger than the men of different colors. But I'm simply here as a candidate to say that I come from a great Black people who produce love warriors in the face of hatred, who produce freedom fighters in the face of U.S. terrorism, of lynching and Jim Crow and Jane Crow, and of wounded healers in the face of trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold up that bloodstained banner, which means I'm in deep solidarity with oppressed people around the world. And yes, that includes my precious Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza.
And you've also been critical of African Americans in power. So what do you make of, you know, current African Americans who hold public office right now? I mean, I think of Linda Thomas Greenfield, who's become the face of the U.S. veto at the Security Council, the U.N. Security Council. But then there's also Kamala Harris, there's Lloyd Austin. I mean, what do you make of these African Americans holding public office right now?
موتناش الصاروخ بده يموتنا الجوع. احنا بالنسبه لنا في الخيام مش عايشين عيشه بني ادمين.
Well, these black faces in high places are there because
black faces in high places. Is that
right? That's exactly. Black faces in high imperial places are there because of the struggles, the blood, sweat, and tears of everyday black people and other folk who joined the Black Freedom Movement. Now they get there and they become rationalizers and justifiers of genocide, of ethnic cleansing. So again, it's hypocrisy. They become complicitous with American criminality. So the same thing with Obama, right? Dropping drones on innocent people in Somalia and Pakistan and Afghanistan. You got seven wars going on at the same time. Dropping 25,000 bombs a year and walking around with a Nobel Peace Prize. Well, you see, that's just ridiculous.
But then, Doctor,
what happens to the legacies of Malcolm X and Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Curtis Mayfield and John Coltrane? We can go on. Nina Simone. That tradition must be made highly visible. So it's not a question of what color you are, your skin pigmentation. It's a question of whether you have the courage to choose integrity, honesty, decency, seeking justice, and being willing to take the hits, being willing to pay the price, being willing to bear the burden.
But then you see how one could turn around, Dr. West, and be like, well, you're critical of all these public figures, but you yourself, you're running to be the head of this American empire, as you call it.
You're absolutely right. I'm running to be head of the American empire in order to dismantle the American empire, in order to disinvest from military and reinvest in the satisfaction of basic social needs of health care and housing and safe communities and quality education. And yes, I'm also running because I think the best of America, and the best of America is still America. The best of America is the Black freedom struggle. Is constituted by those Americans of all colors who have decided to opt for truth, justice, and love. And of course, that's the slogan of my campaign, right? Mm-hmm. Truth, condition of truth, truth allows suffering to speak, justice. Justice is what love looks like in public, and the courage that undergirds it, the willingness to cut against the grain. And I am an internationalist. That is to say, America does not have to be an empire. It must not be an empire. It must be one nation among nations. So that I believe that a baby in Ethiopia, in Guatemala, in Singapore, in New York, in Gaza, in Tel Aviv, they all have the same value. That's my egalitarian internationalism. And I'm deeply committed to that. And I think at this particular historical moment, as the American empire implodes, that the best of America ought to be part and parcel of the conversation, of the struggle, And I tell you this, my brother, well, we know Biden might run out of gas and give up. Trump may be on his way to jail. And we win. And when we win, I'm not going to the White House until every citizen has a house.
But what about those who are saying that, you know, this is a, you know, Cornel West, you're following in the footsteps of Ralph Nader, you know, that you're in 2024, that you're becoming basically, you could possibly be an enabler of Trump going into the White House.
No, I would say that each candidate has to win and earn their votes. 40% of Americans do not vote at all. I spend a lot of time with them.
But do they care about politics?
Well, a lot of times they either care and it's just given up because they know how rotten the system is, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't because they're just too busy. They're struggling trying to survive and what have you. But the notion that somehow somebody can run for office, especially somebody who they know at the moment has much lower percentage, that they become the major or primary cause for the whole system.
Right.
That shows again the hypocrisy of it. You see, if Biden can't make a case, he can't make a case. If Trump can't make a case, he can't make a case. People vote for each one of those because they think they made a case. They vote for me, they think I made a case.
Right.
Yet each candidate has to earn their votes. And of course, it could be the other way around too. They could be stealing from me. If you're going to use those kind of terms, I don't speak in those terms. I just think each candidate makes the case and people choose.
Right. My last question for you, Dr. West. I mean, you've been very outspoken for Gaza and for the situation on the ground, but again, how you know, obviously voicing support and all and calling for a ceasefire, it only goes so far. So how can you really say something or do something that implements change on the ground?
Well, all we can do is hit the streets. All we can do is go to jail. All we can do is put our bodies where our mouths are when we're not in the situation itself. But also on a very personal level, though, brother, we just want our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters to know that they feel so all alone. They feel as if the world doesn't care. They feel as if they are invisible. And we're out there every week to tell them, you are not invisible. We care and love you. We're concerned about you. And I say that to each and every oppressed group, be they in Sudan. I would have said the same thing to Jews in the 1930s. I've seen the same thing to Black folk every day of my life. Same thing to Indigenous people every week. You have to express yourself at that level of deep moral and spiritual solidarity, because I don't have the political and economic power at the moment, but I can still raise my voice. And that's the anthem of Black people. Lift every voice. Mm-hmm. And that voice is tied to a vision. And that vision is driven by a vocation. And that vocation is undergirded by the virtue of courage. And many of us would rather be dead than afraid. We'd rather be a corpse than a coward.
And on that note, Dr. Cornel West, I thank you so much for joining us on Real Talk Online. It's a real pleasure. And I wish you the best of luck with the campaign. I truly do.
I salute you, my brother. You stay strong. God bless your loved ones, man.
Thank you, Dr. West. Thank you so much.